say, hey, I can't pay now, but why don't we just, you know, say, call it, you know, a future obligation when I get back on my feet and I get my first big bonus, you know, I'll come up to date. But I do think that we're going to see some unrealized income this year just based upon employment situations.
Lisa, is it possible for me to introduce myself and give you some input as to why my synagogue has a collection ratio of over 98%?
Sure thing.
Okay. First of all, let me identify myself. My name is Dr. Norman Gordon. I'm a retired dentist and a retired colonel in the United States Air Force. I'm also a registered financial planner, stockbroker, and licensed in insurance. At my synagogue in New Rochelle, at Bethel Synagogue, I'm the financial secretary with a congregation of over 850 families. Now, we do things just a little bit differently, and maybe some of it can be helpful. We have a committee called our Financial Arrangement Committee Team, or FACT, F-A-C-T, Financial Arrangement Committee Team. We're a team of approximately 8 people. I chair the committee, and I make sure our executive director is on the committee. Our controller, he does the reports for us, so he keeps us current on a weekly basis. And our main secretary, of course, who meets most of the people, since the rest of our committee are volunteers. Now, we meet actually every single month, 12 months a year. We meet at 8:30 in the morning to 9:30. Surprisingly, 95% of our committee turns up, because at 9:30 promptly, we cancel our meeting and schedule another meeting so everyone could go to work or fulfill their daily basis. Now, when we have problems where we find certain people are not meeting their obligations, we send out one letter notifying them that they're basically in arrears. Our financial year begins on July 1st, and it normally ended on November 1st by Constitution. What I did, I extended it to our secular year to end on December 31st. And surprisingly, December is a very, very big collection month, because they're using that as a tax write-off. Now, if we don't finish our meeting of the problems that we're having with some of our congregants, as I said, by 9:30, I will the following week, so that we don't sit around for the hour and fool around. Now, after the first notice that they're in arrears, we follow up very shortly with a telephone call. Shortly after, if there's no response, then we go and we set up a personal interview with any one of our 8 members. And surprisingly, that brings in a terrific amount of money on a very personal basis. So our collection for the entire year, although is not met by December 31st, reaches approximately 98% right before Rosh Hashanah.
Well, that's wonderful. Thanks for sharing your methods with us. I'd like to give an opportunity for someone else who has a question, please.
Lisa, this is Howie, the moderator. Another question came in from instant messaging. The question is, several of our older members refuse to sign the renewal form. Do you have a suggestion on how to handle that?
So I'm assuming that the renewal form came into being after they were already members. That's my guess. If this is you,
yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's a couple things you can do. I mean, it depends on certainly their situation. If these people are problem payers, I mean, many of us sort of have, like, you know, that person who's been a member for 50 years and is part of the building, and You know, we are, after all, a synagogue, so sometimes it gets a little tricky to deal with them. But I certainly would send an ambassador to speak to each of them one-on-one, something like what Dr. Gordon was saying, you know, have like his personal interview that they do. I would send an ambassador one-on-one, nothing intimidating, just to talk to this person and say, you know, hey, Mrs. Goldblum, you know, we need to explain to you why this is important. And if you would join, it would, you know, it would be like a beacon and a leader to other people because you're so well respected, and sort of appeal to them as a as an icon of the community, and that their help is needed. And maybe you could even, you know, if you just sort of just crack the exterior and get one or two of them in, they might bring the rest of them with them. And then, you know, if people just put their foot down, I mean, ultimately you're going to have to decide what you want to do about it. You know, if the person's 98 years old and they've been a congregant for 55 years, you know, what are you going to do?
Lisa?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about introducing the renewal form in a congregation that hasn't previously used one, how one, you know, speaks to the congregation and explains that this is now the new procedure, or do you just throw it out there and you know, do it presumptively?
I'm never a big fan of sort of throwing stuff out and doing it presumptively. I think it's a great way to get your head handed to you, so I think this is a wonderful question. I think that communication is key. And so what has to happen is now is the time to start to have a discussion that yes, we're going to introduce this renewal form this year. And you need to buy in on every level so that, you know, you go, you know, you share it with your senior staff, you share it with the executive committee, it goes to the board. And then I would publish the information in your bulletin. And you can say, you know, in these economic times, it's more important for us than ever to have a real true understanding of where our membership stands, who is a member and who not is a member, and therefore we're not going to be sending out high holiday tickets to anyone who doesn't order them on this form and renew their membership, because we need to budget more carefully. Yeah. And this is our tool that we're going to use to do that. And you can even you know, if you're really going to meet resistance, again, I always do recommend sending ambassadors to meet with your toughest customers to get them on the right page, and to even mobilize your board members to call key members and let them know, and you know, use them as a contact into your congregation at large.
How about the rabbi? Is it appropriate for a rabbi to get involved in certain specific identified cases?
Well, look, there are times when someone only feels comfortable speaking to the rabbi, and I know a lot of rabbis who don't want anything to do with this. I mean, they'll just say, I can't be involved in this, it's a congregational issue. But if you have a rabbi who likes to get involved, I would say it's really important to sit down with your rabbi and say, all right, rabbi, if you're going to be involved in this, we need to talk about what the procedure is, because if you're going to be in, you have to be all in, or you can't be in at all. And that the rabbi has to partner with you so that we're not making some people go through an entire rigmarole to get their accommodation, and then other people just go to the rabbi and bang no dues. And, you know, it's not fair. And so if you approach your rabbi and just say, you know, we need to make sure it's apples and apples no matter who is approached, and let's partner together on this, I think that would be well met.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, I think Howie... Howie, did you say you have another question?
No, I do not have another question via IM.
Okay.
Lisa? Yes. Lisa, Steve Katz from Temple Shalom in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Hello.
How are you?
Yeah,
one question. One, the board debate we've kind of had has been over the fact of how much and how hard to press for financial information. We've had, you know, several people express the view of that if members have to go to ask for abatements, and if they find it, you know, to be any sort of difficult experience, they simply won't go in to drop their membership.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious, you know, both based on your experience, you know, what is the appropriate, I guess, you know, way of handling how much information you should get? You know, is there sort of a guideline onto that? I realize it's different in different communities, and is that argument, you know, you see a lot of that where people, if they feel they have to go for an abatement at all, they'll just drop it if there's any sort of, you know, any sort of pushback or negotiation.
Well, okay, great question or questions. First of all, yes, there's always going to be someone who says, if I have to ask, I'm out of here. And that's well, one of the reasons why it's really important that every single person who doesn't renew membership, every resignation spot comes in, must get a phone call by somebody who's trained to make those phone calls, you know, who asks those questions, who says, you know, gee, you know, Marie, I saw that you didn't renew your membership this year, and we were wondering, you know, why you're not going to be a member anymore, and digging around and making sure that they find that opportunity to say, you know, hey, just so you know, if this has anything to do with financials, you know, we love you and you're part of our community, and we don't let people end their membership because they need an accommodation. So, you know, let us work with you on that. That message has to get delivered in print, verbally, every way that you deliver it. And so that's the only way you're going to catch those people who just leave rather than ask. So that's one. Now for the next part. I think that people have to really have a sense that it's going to be confidential. And that's one of the reasons why I like the form that we're going to send you all soon when we get off the phone, is you can't tell who it is by looking at it, because it doesn't have any names, doesn't have an address or a phone number. There's no identifier. It's just, you know, congregant number, you know, application number, you know, 6, application number 7. And I wouldn't, I had a colleague who, when he was an executive director in a synagogue and someone would come in and say, how do I know it's confidential? He would actually hand them someone else's folder that had no identifiers in it and say, can you tell me who that congregant is? And of course they couldn't. And he would say, because that's how confidential this is. You know, you can't figure out from our form who's making the ask. And so it's important that the committee is small. It's important that they're trusted people, and that they do their job, which is not, you know, considering fairly and not talking about it afterwards. And so you do have to definitely take responsibility that you have to create an atmosphere of trust for people to make that ask.
So then two very quick questions. One is, right now our executive director is the sole person who decides adjustments. Do you recommend that there is a committee? And the second question, which we got from our female board members, was this note that females do not like filling out forms, that they would rather have interviews or discussions. And have you found that to be true?
Well, in my experience, as a woman,
they said, you know, females rather talk about the situation. You can get the same information, but they dread filling out a form.
You know what? Listen. That's just funny to me. Okay, let me answer you. I think that you should say this, you know, so what? So if someone says, I don't want to fill out a form, but I'm willing to give you the information. So, yeah, invite them in and fill it out with them. Say, what's the answer to this? What's the answer? I mean, what skin off our nose is it to do that? That'd be like, you know, filling it out for anyone who, like, you know, broke their hand and couldn't write. So what? Well, you know, I think we shouldn't create needless barriers. And having said that, you, I do have heard of congregations that have executive directors who take sole responsibility for this. That's fine. I mean, a lot of our congregations don't have executive directors, or if they do, they're it's just not something that would fit in their purview. As long as your community, as your leadership is really willing to support that person and back them up and not second guess them because they are staff and that can be uncomfortable, yeah, it's fine. It's fine.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Question regarding the sample plan that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, you mentioned that there was the idea of putting a plan into place early ahead of time before you have an issue can be dealt with calmly. In the forms that you are going to circulate after the telephone conference, is it possible for you to circulate a sample plan?
I don't have that at the ready. You know, and it's, I mean, it's certainly something you could email me and I could try to like walk you through the process. But the focus needs to be if X happens, then Y. Because you don't, you know, for instance, I compare this to, and I'm certainly not getting into that in this conversation, but like into like questions about intermarried families. Like, you know, if there's an intermarried family, Jewish mother, non-Jewish father, they have a baby, what can the non-Jewish parent do on the Bima at the baby naming? I'm sure every synagogue on this call has had that conversation because they know it's either already happened or it's going to happen. This is that same thing. It's, we know this is going to happen, so let's think about all of these situations. You know, the person is in arrears, can they have a life cycle event? The person quit the synagogue, can the rabbi still do the funeral? The person isn't making their payments as to the agreement, what do we do about the bar mitzvah? So I think you have to, you know, and like I said, you can contact me separately and I'm happy to talk about it. I don't have anything prepared on that at the moment, though.
Thank you.
Interesting to think about that.
Lisa, you mentioned that there was a paper on, I forget whether it was you or Howard actually, that there was a paper on the USCJ site.
Yeah, what's going to happen at the end of our call here tonight, Howard is going to send everybody a copy of the paper that has all of the forms and attachments and, you know, sort of outlines the points that I made on the call here tonight, so you all have that. And then it actually is going to get posted up on the USCJ site, but you guys will have it tonight. Before we get it up. And then once we have it up, you'll get an email saying that the recording of tonight's call is there, as well as the PDF of this paper.
Okay, terrific. Thank you.
In fact, just to clarify, you'll have those who are on the call tonight, within an hour or so after the call, we will email you the document at the email address that you registered with for the call. And this group tonight will also have access to the recording of the call, so that if you want to share this with other leadership in your congregation and follow along with the document while you're re-listening to the call, you'll be able to do that as well.
Is it too late if you have not registered for the call but are on it to be able to get a copy right away?
The answer is, if you why don't you email me privately and I'll send you everything.
Okay.
And I'm at goldberg@uscj.org.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now I heard another question starting.
That's okay. So this is Sam Telzer with Temple Shalom, also in beautiful Greenwich, Connecticut.
Hello.
One of the questions that came up at a board, at an executive committee meeting, is whether or not, since the majority of our folks that ask for a dues abatement or a dues relief tend to be in the senior citizen realm, whether or not we should create a category that alleviates the executive directors he talked about, of having to spend a lot of time dealing with dues adjustments for those that are on fixed incomes. Would you recommend that synagogues look at their dues structure and possibly create categories so that the entire process becomes more streamlined?
Okay. This is the point where everybody's grandma is going to want to shoot me. If you don't have senior dues, you are a lucky, lucky community. And I would not create them, because many seniors are not on such fixed incomes, and they have money to be snowbirds and to travel and do things. And to say to them, "We're, you know, this is available easily," I just don't think that it would serve you well. I mean, you know your community best, but I can tell you that in the community that I worship in, we actually had this conversation, and I was the congregant jumping up and down in the back saying, no, don't do that. It's not going to be good for us in the long run.
I'm not a supporter of it because I'm the VP of Finance, so I get to deal with...
All right, so you're speaking my language here, right?
I get to deal with the write-offs and things like that. I'm just asking to see what others do, because we always like to know that we're not the outlier. And no, we do not have, we have a very simplified due structure. We do not have a senior citizens category. But I want to go back to something somebody said, which is that, you know, we take the approach, if you want to ask for a dues adjustment because you believe that you're not using some of the services, would you go to the town that you live in and say, I don't want to pay the full property tax, because I don't have children in school, I don't use the
Absolutely.
Library.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's really the approach we take, although the issue we do run into, and this is what Steve asked about, is we seem to get a fairly stiff pushback when we ask people to disclose information, and in many instances, it's almost under the veiled threat, if you make me do this, then I just won't bother re-upping my membership. And in any economy, you don't want to lose members, but in today's economy, the question is a member that pays a reduced number better than no member at all?
Well, that is the question, and the other question is that if you are letting some people get reduced dues without going through the process, but pushing other people through the process, people will lose faith in the process, and then you may get really big pushback from the people who did it by the rules. And I think that's that way a lot in life. I always say, you know, if you yell loud enough, you get all kinds of accommodations made, but then it's not fair for the person who followed the rules. And I do think that the ambassador approach is the best approach. I mean, look, there's going to be some that are you're going to have to just take on a case-by-case basis because we're dealing with human beings here. But I would try as hard as you could to keep the process true. So that you don't end up with people saying, well, the rules are for some people and not for others. And just regarding your question about senior dues, you know, your president via United Synagogue's president's listserv or your executive director via the executive director's listserv could actually do a little survey for you and ask people what they're doing for senior dues, and you could get more information that way.
Lisa, a follow-up question to that is, what about younger member dues or new member dues for either people who are coming in as new congregants at any age, I suppose, but particularly for people in their 20s or 30s, perhaps without children, but they want to join a congregation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I do see a lot of congregations that are offering discount dues or no dues. I mean, certainly for people in their 20s, you know, these guys are getting out of school and can barely land jobs at this point. And, you know, if you want to just let them join for what it costs you in postage, I encourage that because that's what makes them affiliate when they're able and be good donors as they get older. But as far as these dues plans go, I think the questions you have to ask are, you know, if you've run it in the past, it's following up with the people and saying, in a survey saying, would you have joined when you joined without the discount? And also seeing, do they stay after the discount goes? There, too, we could probably get you some survey data via our listservs, presidents, executive directors, and membership to sort of ask those questions. You know, my sense is, you know, if you want to try to do half price dues, you know, till your youngest child's in, you know, third grade, I think the only way for you to see if that works for you is to say, well, how many members do you have who don't yet have kids in third, whose oldest child's not yet in third grade? And also, do you have a preschool? Are those preschool families converting into members, or do they leave during that period until third grade? And then going after those people and saying, well, what would have made you stay? And that's the only way you can find out what would work in your community.
Lisa?
Yes.
Hi, it's Ben Neiman in Greensboro, North Carolina at Beth Davis Synagogue.
Hi.
We have a situation where sometimes we get members who are on adjusted dues, and sometimes it's hard to get them off of adjusted dues. Do you have any suggestions for that?
I do. I would say to you that adjusted dues have to be renewed every year so that every year they need to go through the process of applying and being granted, and there should be some kind of something that says that it's expected that you could, you know, it is our wish that you would raise your increment yearly. But I would say nobody just rolls it over year after year. Everybody has to reapply every year because otherwise they'll never move off.
Right, and we have no senior dues either.
Okay, thanks for telling us.
The best thing we ever did was getting rid of that category.
You're speaking my language. I couldn't agree more. I think we have time for two more questions because we're hoping to be I think we promised we'd be done by 9 o'clock, so whoever's next, go ahead.
Lisa, this is Dean Mandel from the Yorktown Jewish Center in New York.
Hello.
Hi. I have a question about interfaith family dues.
Mm-hmm.
What happens with us is they wind up paying the single member rate, but yet use it as a family. So I'm curious how you handle that.
I'm so glad you asked me this question. I have a very passionate opinion about it. I actually believe that intermarried families should pay full dues because otherwise we're giving it's like we're giving a gift to the intermarried or a discount for the intermarried, which seems like crazy to me. You know, I don't know how your community is, but I know my community, we welcome the non-Jewish spouse. I mean, they're not a full member. We, you know, follow all the dues, all the rules, of course, but they can be active in men's club and sisterhood and even some limited participation of reading English prayers from the Bima. So, you know, why should that family not pay family dues? They could participate in the family education committee and all kinds of things. So And the other part of that argument is, you know, someone might say, well, my spouse isn't Jewish, they're not going to participate. Well, how many families do we have where someone says, can I join as a single? Because, you know, my husband, he's never going to come here. And the rule is, certainly, you know, in many of the congregations I've worked at, is, you know, if you're married and your spouse lives in your house, then you pay family dues.
One further question. What about people resigning who have significant arrears?
That's one of the things that you have to decide. Your community has to decide, are you going to go after that money or are you going to write it? I would tell you that, you need to decide what your position's going to be in that venue without the personalities. So you need to say, well, here's what we can do. We can continue to send them bills and just keep sending, and hope they send us something. We can send them a bill that says, if we don't hear from you by X date, we're going to send you to collections, but then you have to be ready to send them to collections. So you have to have these conversations now so that you have a plan. But I wouldn't, why let them off the hook?
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Howie?
We have time for maybe one more question if anybody has.
Yes, it's David Perlman with Colony in Tampa, Florida.
David.
We've just recently switched from a fair share dues system to a fixed dues system.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't go very well the first year. I was wondering what advice you may have on how we can improve the process.
I think that I would need to talk to you more about what your process was for making the change and how you communicated the change. So what I'd like to invite you to do is send me an email. I'm glass, G-L-A-S-S, at uscj.org. And let's have because I need a lot of information from you to sort of talk to you about it. And I'm happy to do that, so just send me an email and we'll get together.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
So with that, I want to again thank Lisa Harris-Glass, the Executive Director of USCJ's New Jersey region, for presenting this content, this information to us this evening. This has been a very successful evening, at least from the perspective of us reaching a large number of folks in a number of different regions. We have people on the call tonight from California to New England to Florida, and about 110 people are on the call this evening, and we thank you for being part of this, and we hope that you'll look for other opportunities that we're going to be offering in the coming weeks and months to participate in these virtual seminars and teleconferences. We encourage both you and other members of your lay and professional leadership to take advantage of these services that the United Synagogue is providing to you. Again, we're going to be emailing out the packet of information and links to the recording of the call. And we wish everyone a Laila Tov, a good evening, and we hope to hear from you soon. Be well.